Hi, I'm Kim Asher. Welcome to another exciting, gripping episode of Offshore Banter. What number are we up to now? 6, 7, 8? I don't know, something like that. Well, you're still here. Welcome. Anyway, if you enjoy this content, like, subscribe, all that stuff. Right, let's get to it. This is the story today of the worst ship I've ever been on. And from previous episodes, you might think, well, you know, Kim, she's been around the block a bit. Therefore, you would expect the story to take place somewhere like Nigeria, Angola, Congo, you know, one of the tourist spots of the world I've worked in. But it's not. The worst ship I've ever been on is, funnily enough, in one of the countries with consistently the highest standards of living, the happiest places to live, high on everything that's good in the universe, that a human being wants to have a nice environment. Denmark. Now, I used to live in Denmark, love the country. So for any Danish people out there watching this, hiya Denmark, they are long tid since you have boy, Copenhagen, nu jeg har glemt, must have been dansk. So, but anyway, yeah, elsker Denmark. Hiya. Sorry, that was just me saying hello to Danish people in my bad Danish. But I just wanted to say that because, you know, I don't want them to think I'm having a bash at the country. I'm not. It's a great place. And unlike Norway, Denmark has really good food. Sorry, Norway. You've got a better standard of living offshore, though. And beautiful. You've got hills and stuff. Denmark's like a pancake. So anyway, right, where was I? Oh yeah, worst ship I've ever worked on. I was doing a PLGR, pre-lay grapnel run. So this is at the end of the pre-construction process. Done all your surveys, you've done your UXO clearance, unexploded ordnance. That's where you've cleared the cable route or the worksite of any sea mines, torpedoes, parachute bombs, all the kinds of things that might have been scattered around the sea during the First or Second World Wars, you know, that period of time when everyone goes insane. But anyway, so there we are, still decades later, cleaning up all of these things. And do you get lots of UXOs? Yes, you do. Particularly in places like the Baltic, in the North Sea, the Channel, a lot of places around the world. You get at least a handful of potential targets that have to be detonated on pretty much any site I've ever worked on. And so it really is a significant issue even now. It's still some stuff from the First World War over a century later. I think, is it in the South Baltic, off Polish waters, they expect to find a bunch of mustard gas shells, artillery shells that were dumped there, containing, you know, super concentrated chlorine formulations that are literally designed to, you know, kill people, chemical weapons. So in some parts of the world you get these, you know, like off the coast of like the Netherlands and stuff, you get these parachute bombs that have an aluminium casing that are packed with high explosives, which are really hard to detect because aluminium doesn't have such a strong ferromagnetic signature, all that kind of stuff. Sorry, digressing, technical stuff again. But the bottom line is, you've gone through, you've used multi-beam, sub-bottom profilers, magnetometers, whatever it is you've used to identify all of these different things along the routes that you're going to be constructing on. And then you go and blow anything up that you think needs to get blown up. And then at the end of it, you're almost ready to lay a cable on the seabed. But before you do, it makes a lot of sense to do a thing called a PLGR. Pre-lay grapnel run, where you get a small ship, normally like a tug, anchor handlers the best, and you just drop the steel cable into the water, and on the back of the steel cable there's all of this kind of like metal stuff, and it could be a row of grappling hooks. Or, you know, like a mattress of like heavy chain links or something like that, all woven together. Something that has a wide surface area that you can just drag along the seabed and just make sure that anything that's there just gets swept out of the way. So then you're in a good place to go to get your clearance certificate, and you're authorized to lay your cable. A PLGR is really a basic job. You just need a vessel that can follow a track and a bit of steel, and you drag it on the seabed. That's it. Not difficult work, and therefore it's often done by relatively low-cost vessels, maybe a bit older, companies that are bidding very aggressively to do it, all that kind of stuff. So that's definitely one of the areas that on a construction project you quite often are pinched by the penny pinchers into not necessarily the best, but just an effective solution. But on this occasion, and look, this company has actually gone bust. It's gone bankrupt. So even though I have a policy of never naming companies, projects, people, vessels, anything like that, in this case, I actually could name the company. However, I'm not going to. Not because of that company, because honestly, they deserve all the bad publicity they could possibly get, even though they're history now. But for any contractor that subcontracted to them, it might be a bit embarrassing for them. And some of those might still be my clients from time to time. And we all sometimes end up with a bad subcontractor, don't we? So I was sent out there. I'm trying to remember who sent me out, whether it was the cable company or was it the main developer? I honestly can't remember who sent me out there. Can't remember. But I found myself... Oh, that's really annoying now. Oh, I know, it was the EPC. It was the main contractor that sent me out there. That's right. I remember now. Because we had 4 clients on this vessel, which for a PLGR is really excessive. I mean, the crew was only about 8 people. So to have 4 of them as, an additional 4 people as clients is just insane. But the cable company sent out a client. The developer sent out a client. I was there. Actually, I think the cable company sent out 2 clients. That's right. 1 for days and 1 for nights. Because they really wanted to make sure it was their first major cable project in the North Sea or the Baltic area. And they wanted to make sure that their cable was safe. So they sent out 2 reps. And then there was 1 from the main developer, and there was myself. So there's 4 clients, and from the moment I saw this vessel in the distance, I thought, okay, this is going to be fun. And when I got onto it, oh dear. First impressions, look, if you're an offshore veteran, if you spend a long time on vessels, ships, boats, sailboats, powerboats, doesn't matter, you instantly know. You have an instinct. The first time you see a vessel, you have an instinct as to what your experience is going to be like and how difficult the job will be. And in this instance, first impression was, this is going to be rough. From a far distance, it looked like a decent anchor handler. A bit older, but okay. But as soon as you got a bit up close and personal with it, you could see everything, like the Panama chocks, which are like the small oval-shaped holes that the lines the rope will run through, stuff like that. The way the line management was, the ropes were, on the deck. Corroded paint and all that kind of faded paint. It wasn't just corroded, it was faded. And all of that stuff, everything, all the housekeeping of the vessel was just terrible. And that's always a first indicator. And then you get on board and you go into the accommodation block, or you head up to the bridge and you're looking around and you just see, bins aren't clean or haven't been emptied. So garbage is piling up everywhere. And there's a smell. Like, the smell is the first thing that gives you an indication how clean the vessel is or not. How it has been looked after. It just had this brackish... So my first impression was that this vessel was a Maersk vessel. So Maersk have a very distinctive, sky blue, powder blue colour on their vessels, which most of us will be familiar with, right? Now, it looked to me, because it wasn't Maersk that was the operator of the vessel or the owner or anything to do with it, but it looked to me like this company, being a Danish company, probably was buying up old Maersk stock, like vessels that had passed their sell-by date at the tail end of their lifespan, or even past their lifespan in real terms. Bought them up for like scrap prices and then tried to squeeze a few more years out of them doing, you know, cheap charters for things like PLGR jobs and stuff like that in the Baltic and the North Sea. Oh dear. I just dumped my bags because I was busy. I had phone calls to do. I had emails to catch up on. I just finished traveling, just arrived on the vessel. That, you know, you make contact with the office and all that stuff. Had a few personal calls to make. And then at that point, you know, we were ready to leave the port, so you want to watch that happen. Well, I got to bed quite late, and when I went into my cabin, I got into my bed, and I still remember that feeling that the sheets were filthy, crawling, almost alive, and I felt the scratching, and I'm like, what the hell's that scratching? And I reached down, and it was somebody's toenail cuttings that were in the bed with me, scratching against my body. I felt sick. I'm like, oh no. And so I went out to find the housekeeping staff. And I said to them, look guys, my bed sheets haven't been changed. I don't know if they've ever been changed. But these guys literally had no idea, no training, nothing at all. They were ABs, and they had to double as housekeeping staff, and they didn't even think about changing bed sheets or cleaning things or anything like that. And as an AB, really, a lot of that stuff, it wouldn't be their job anyway. So I helped them change my bed sheets. We managed to find some clean bed sheets, and I just knew at that point it was going to be grim. Then, when we were sailing underway, and it was about a 24-hour transit site, that's when I would do my inspections. I mean, I'd do cursory glance around the vessel to make sure things were sort of pretty safe to start with. But as soon as we're underway, I've got more time to go around and have a look at all the different bits and pieces that I think, okay, is this fit for the purpose? And for a PLGR job, it doesn't need to be that fit. It just needs to be a serviceable. It just needs to be a serviceable. Oh my goodness. It just needs to be a serviceable. Oh my god, why can't I say that word? It just needs to be a serviceable vessel with the equipment to tow this, you know, prelay grapnel array along the seabed. That's it. It's all it needs. And I started exploring. I looked on the winch drum, the drum that the cable that does the towing is spooled around, right? For a variety of different reasons, I have never once seen a spool drum that's got different diameter cables that have been spliced together, steel cables spliced together. This drum was wrapped around with three or even four different diameter steel cables spliced together at different points. I think one of them was spliced and it was four different cables because it had three connections in it. So one was spliced, and then two that just had, like, rigging that was, you know, connecting the two different types of cable. And I looked at that and thought, that is terrible. You can't deploy a tow line that's three different diameters of steel. And then also looking at the cable, it was, like, there was no grease on it. It was dry as a bone, and it was corroded. Like, a lot of the cable was really corroded. And I looked at it and thought, this cable is not fit for purpose at all. This entire winch drum is not fit for purpose. And I went up to the bridge and said, can I see the certificates for the cable that we're going to be used for doing the PLGR? Because I've just had a look at the winch drum. You've got several different diameters of cable on that thing. Not acceptable. It's not normal practice at all. And looking at the state of the cables, they look ancient. They don't look well maintained. There's no grease on them. There's nothing at all. This is a really bad looking array, and we don't have to have, you know, super high standards, but we have to meet minimum basic safety standards. They went silent. That was like the captain and the chief mate There were only, I think there were four officers of the watch on the vessel. So, like, captain, chief mate, first mate, second mate. And there'll be two on, effectively on watch at any time. Like, who does this person think they are asking these questions? And I had a few other questions as well about the state of different things. Like, I think there was a fire extinguisher that was well past the expiry date, which I noticed, which just made me, you know, once you start peering underneath the rug and seeing the dirt there, you start looking at everything, because you can just know that everywhere you look, everything's going to be terrible. There was some correspondence backwards and forwards between my client, i.e. the main EPC contractor, and their office, and then they started swapping emails, and eventually I got a phone call saying they've provided us with a certificate of purchase of the cable, and they're claiming that this cable that they're using to tow has never been used. And I said, look, there are four different diameter cables on this winch block, so really they should be providing us with four different certificates saying that these are in date, serviceable, safe, all that stuff. And they said, well, they're claiming that even though the cable is old, it's never been used, and therefore the certificate of purchase covers it. And I said, do you buy that? I got a reply basically saying, well, it's what they can deliver and we need to get this job done. And I'm like, oh, it's one of those attitudes, is it? Great. I went up to the bridge and I said, okay, you've given us one certificate of purchase, which is about 10 years out of date. And I've been authorized, or instructed rather, to say that that's okay to proceed. But that's fine. But what about the other three cables that are on there? And then they said, okay, we've got nothing for that, but we're not going to use any of the other cables. None of them will go in the water, and therefore it's okay. Like, you guys are just full of it. Of course, the first time we put PLGR in the water, the cable parted. So that was fun. Parted means split. Cable went ping, like that. They just re-terminated. They, you know, spliced it together, basically. And that happened several times on this job. This job, I think, lasted about 4 weeks. It's only meant to be a 1 week job. Lasted for 4 weeks. And the main reason it lasted 4 weeks, this really simple job, was because a couple of days into the job, they lost the propeller. Just fell off. Just fell into the water. Just disappeared onto the seabed. Big brass propeller. Bang. Gone. On this enormous, you know, anchor handler, not enormous, but a big anchor handler, like a 60-meter, 200-foot vessel, right? So we had to limp to, I think it's the only dry dock in that part of the Baltic. It's a small Danish island, and they have a dry dock there. So we went to this dry dock, we limped in there. Luckily, they didn't have any other vessels in at the moment, so we proceeded to go to this dry dock and went in there. And I hate being in dry docks, because any time, if your accommodation is still on the vessel while you're in dry dock, any work done outside the vessel just resonates through the steel hull, and it's just this metallic drumming all the time, like chipping paint. It's the worst sound in the world. Oh, that chipping gun. All the time, all the way through the hull. So the bottom line is, we stayed in this dry dock for 2 weeks. Well, the propeller was basically being put back on. They got another small vessel to go out. They managed to log the position where the propeller was lost, and a small dive vessel went out and was able to recover it. So that was all well and good. We had to wait a few days for that, and then they managed to get the prop back on. But that took a couple of weeks, because they had to get equipment. The dry dock wasn't ready for us, and there was a lot of waiting around. Hurry up and wait. Stand by to stand by. The good thing was that on this island, which was quite small, although it was quite weird, it felt a little bit like A Fistful of Dollars, you know, where you've got two ends of the town sort of thing. My understanding is that this island had two villages on it, opposite ends of the island, and one end hated the other end, and there was some sort of blood feud going on. It was a bit weird. It was the Danish equivalent of, you know, Deliverance. But, you know, the people we came across were lovely, like most Danish people are. But there was a bar just up the road from the dry dock. And it was literally the only thing on the island except for the small convenience store, like a small supermarket, very, very small. For a supermarket, you know, it had just enough basic provisions for the people on the island to live. Not much variety, but I was able to get some of my favourite Danish food. It's hard to get outside of Denmark. Some of the good Danish cheeses and marinated herring and all that kind of stuff. So I enjoyed that for a few days. But of course we found ourselves in the bar every night. Of course, swapping stories like this story, right? Offshore banter. A couple of weeks of that. We're getting land sick. You know, forget seasick. We just wanted to get back out there and finish off this job at this point. And so we went back out there. Cable kept passing. Oh, no, that's the other thing. So while we were in the dry dock, they decided to do a muster drill. Now, a muster drill, if you don't know, is when you have simulated emergency, where you have to go to your muster stations, which are where you go in the event of an emergency, and that's so the crew is prepared to abandon ship if required, where they can do a head count of the crew, make sure everyone's accounted for, you know, all of that kind of stuff, right? So every single time a ship leaves port, on a construction vessel at least, on a two-week rotation, you'll always do a muster drill. So it was time for us to do a muster drill. Now, it is standard convention on construction vessels on every single project, every ship, everywhere in the world I've ever been. If the vessel is in port, when you do a muster drill and the gangway is connected to the vessel, then you muster on land, on the quayside next to the vessel. Why? Because if it's a true emergency and the vessel's in danger, in port, then the safest place to be is on the quayside. And so it's standard practice. Normal. I know that. Everyone else that was a veteran on the ship knew that, like all of the other clients that were with me. So, but the thing... Oh God, yeah, I forgot that. One thing to another. When the klaxon went off in the main accommodation block and up on the bridge and inside the vessel, two of the clients, there wasn't enough space to put everybody, all the crew members, all of us, inside the main accommodation block on the vessel. So they had rigged up this 40-foot accommodation converted container on the back deck, which was where, you know, two of the clients were housed. But of course, they'd done such a half-assed job that the 40-foot container was not connected to any alarm systems or anything else like that. So when the alarms went off, the two clients, and this was in the middle of the night as well, they did it, I think, on purpose just to try and irritate us. But they did it at, like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning or something, when all of us sort of get up at like 5 a.m. to start a 6 a.m. shift type of thing, right? So, particularly when we're on dry dock, there's no need for it at all. Because everyone's out of shift. We're in dry dock for 2 weeks. No one's staying on night shift for 2 weeks during that. I heard the alarm going off. The first thing I did was realize that the two guys on the container in the back deck wouldn't have heard it. So I went up to the container, banging on the door, got them out of bed, door opened up, and one of them bleary-eyed, "What is it? What's wrong? What's wrong? We've got a muster drill. Sorry, got a muster drill. There's no alarm in this accommodation block. Get yourselves out on the quayside, lads." All four of us went down to the quayside and mustered there, standing literally right next to the gangway. And then the captain of this vessel blew a gasket because we weren't at our muster station. And we were all looking at each other like, "But this is where you muster when you're in port." He wouldn't have it at all. Then he made a formal complaint about all of us to our respective companies, how we were terrible during a muster drill and that we didn't know the basics of being a seafarer, stuff like that. And this thing just went on and on, like this entire job. The only bright side about it in terms of the vessel performance was they had this guy who was the head cook, well, the only cook, again, Filipino guy, and he had spent about 20 years as a cook on big cruise ships, you know, and he said that he spent about 10 years on the egg station, right? So he would, like, in the morning breakfast on a cruise ship, it's like, I don't know, however many people, 500, 1,000 passengers on it. I have no idea how many tourists go on a cruise ship. But he would be there every breakfast, and he would do omelets, fried eggs, boiled eggs, whatever type of egg he wanted. He was like the Yoda of eggs. And I was trying to calculate, let's say there's 500 people on a cruise ship, which again is a wild guess. And let's say, like, some people have 2 or 3 eggs, some people have no eggs. Let's say the average person has 1 egg. So he was cooking 500 eggs a day for 6 months of the year for 10 years. So that's 500 times, 180, let's say 200. So that's, 1,000, 10, that's 100,000 eggs every half a year. And then for 10 years, it's 1 million eggs. So that's right, because I remember calculating it. I was thinking, you've cooked 1 million eggs. This guy, honestly, I like to cook. And every single day when he was doing breakfast, because it was a really small, very informal galley setting, the galley was quite open to the mess. So there was no barrier there. And he was a very friendly guy. He was a little bit depressed about having to work on that vessel after so many years of, working on big, beautiful ships and stuff. I don't know why his career had taken him down that path, but he found himself there and he was a bit down about it. And I had quite a good relationship with him. So every morning when he was cooking breakfast for us, I said, can I watch you cook eggs? Because I'll never have a chance to watch anyone that has mastered eggs as much as you ever again in my life. And I want to see how you fry eggs. I want to see how you make an omelette. So I was watching everything. It was a gas stove. I remember watching the gas setting, how far it was. When he put the oil in, was it cold oil or hot? Did he preheat the oil? Was the pan hot or cold? If somebody ordered eggs this way or that way. And I just remember just watching this guy absolutely nail eggs every single time perfectly. And I still can't. I can't for the life of me, I can't remember how he did it, but all the different variations. But yeah, so that was the good thing about the vessel. I always try and find something good on there. After all, it is your home while you're there. And the other thing that really irritated me, about halfway through, obviously we had to get some fresh provisions on board. So we had this delivery arrive of, like eggs and milk, cheese and meat and stuff like that, fruit, vegetables, all the usual sort of fresh produce arrives. You can always tell the quality of a crew and of a ship, and it starts at the top and works its way down, right? If the senior management on the vessel is bad, same as a company, then the culture of that company is terrible. Without a shadow of doubt, it starts at the top. All of the good ships I've been on, when you get a delivery of fresh produce, if you're up and you're not working and you're available, all hands on deck, you all go out there and you lug boxes together. The clients, the captain, everybody. If you're not on the bridge, if you're not in an active role, if you're not involved in operations, if you're not sleeping, you drop what you're doing and you go and help with the supplies. Several pallets of fresh produce arrived on the back deck, and the captain, the chief mate, and the second mate, second officer, whoever it was, three of the marine crew were doing nothing on the bridge. There was also a couple of Danish ABs as well, I think. And then there were, like, everyone else was Filipino except for the clients. Of course, as soon as I saw fresh supplies had arrived, I put on my PPE, went down to the back deck, put on some gloves, standing there, and I'm like, right, let's help. And I started moving boxes around. And it was raining. I remember it was raining. I definitely remember getting wet. I was the only person that was helping. There was, like, two Filipino guys that had to move these pallets of fresh produce. And I mean stacked high, big, high pallets filled, like, several tons of produce. And my first thought was, well, where's the captain? Where's the chief mate? Where's the second officer? Where are the other clients, for that matter? About a quarter of the way through this process, knowing that they were up there on the bridge, I just walked up to the bridge, climbed all of the stairs up to the bridge, opened the door, and I see them all there, sitting, drinking coffee, looking down at the three of us that have been lugging all of this produce around. And I just laid into them. I said, what the hell do you lot think you're doing, sitting there drinking coffee, talking crap, while we're breaking our backs down there, making sure that we've all got supplies enough for all of us to eat for the next few weeks? Is that how you think a ship should be running? You should be ashamed of yourselves. If I, as the client, can do it, you should be down there mucking in with the rest of us. I'm absolutely embarrassed to be on the ship if this is the type of shipmates I have with me. And I went back down, carried on, and they still didn't come down. I was fuming. That sort of thing irritates me. I've always been the sort of person, the more junior you are, the harder the work is that you do, the more physical, the dirtier, the more I respect you. It takes real commitment and guts and determination and expediency to carry on doing that kind of work day in and day out, regardless of the conditions or the elements or how laborious it is or what risk you put yourself under. Those are the people I really respect. And the more senior you are, the more you need to be able to justify why you're as good as you are and doing the job that you're doing. And when I see that kind of thing, it irritates the hell out of me. So, didn't forget that. That was like the worst ship I was on. It felt unsafe. There was also that. This happened twice. We're literally in transit at night in the Baltic. I went up to the bridge, just starting my shift. I think I was on midnight till midday, because I wanted to keep an eye on both shifts, the day and the night shifts. So I was midnight to midday, I think. And there was no one on the bridge. No one. Not an AB, not an officer of the watch, nobody. And we're in transit. I could not believe it. I went up to have a look. I mean, the first thing I did was go and make sure there was nothing impending, like we're going to hit anything. Really was worried, genuinely worried about the safety of the vessel and the safety of anything else in the water around us. Then, I pulled the alarm. I just pulled the alarm on the vessel, like everyone must have. Why not? And I think it took 3 or 4 minutes before anybody came up to the bridge, and the person who came up to the bridge was the captain, but he was asleep. You could see that he had just pulled himself out of bed. And it was about another 5 minutes after that before the officer that should have been on watch turned up to the bridge. He was dressed, I'll give him that. I could not believe it. Could not believe it. And there was another time after that. Of course, I dressed them down and I escalated it as hard as I could back to the beach, back to the office. Wrote a full incident report, all of that kind of stuff. They promised to buck their ideas up. But it happened again. Like, you know, the officer of the watch went to go to the toilet, use the head, while the washroom, whatever your lingo is, while on watch. But there was no AB, there was no second mate, there was no other officer on the bridge. There was no one. And again, I came up to the bridge and found the bridge deserted. And I just put my head down in utter disgust. And about 20, 30 seconds after that, he came back to the bridge and I said, what on earth do you think you're doing? It just kept happening. Stuff like that kept happening all the time on this vessel. So anyway, I think I've been rabbiting on for ages on this one. But that was the worst ship I've ever been on. It was the worst because of terrible bridge officers that clearly couldn't get a job anywhere else, and so they were working on this rusting wreck. You know, the company obviously was making what it could out of scrap metal. Razor blades, that thing should have been razor blades years ago. It was the worst because of the safety culture and the lack of anything that supported safety and its operational understanding and just everything about it, every aspect of about it, I felt unsafe, I felt dirty, I felt thoroughly uncomfortable from start to finish on that job. And all of the times I caught them doing things wrong, I only caught two-thirds of what went on, but even then, a lot of the bad stuff, I probably did that the time it wasn't there, thinking, oh, that terrible creature's not here, let's do the bad stuff now, so we won't be seen. Anyway, it was only a few months after I got off that vessel, I heard they went bankrupt, and I positively celebrated knowing that such an unsafe operator was out of the market forever. So there you go. That was another episode. The worst vessel I've ever been on. Surprisingly in Danish waters. Thanks for joining me on this episode. I hope you had some fun here. If you're on watch, if you're at sea right now, don't do what those idiots did. Maintain a good watch. Keep your eyes peeled, sailor. Anyway, no, but seriously, if you're on watch, if you're away from home, if you're at sea right now, have a good watch, stay safe, be a good shipmate, look after those around you, and everyone get home safely. Lots of love. Bye.